For those who might have their personal missal or a Magnificat, and you're trying to follow along with the readings, and are wondering why we're wearing white instead of green, you're not going crazy. These were different readings than for the Sunday. So the bishop gave us the permission and the encouragement to celebrate today as the Feast of St. Luke. St. Luke is normally celebrated on the 18th of October. And normally, whenever it falls on a Sunday, of course, we would celebrate the Sunday because it takes precedence usually, but the bishop can give permission for that to be done. And the reason being, of course, is that in this local area, as the cases of COVID continue to rise in our particular region, St. Luke, being a physician back in the day, is also the patron saint of healthcare workers and certainly a patron of the sick. So we want to, as we go through this Mass, invoke his intercession on behalf of those who seek to alleviate the sufferings of all those who suffer, particularly of illness. So that's the reason why we're doing that. So I'm going to refer very briefly to this reading, a couple of these readings. The gospel here, from the Gospel of Luke, speaks of the sending out of the 72. And one of the things that they're mandated to do, of course, is to heal the sick, as well as forgive sins and cast out demons and all of that. The idea, of course, is that from the very beginning, the church and its mission involves the alleviation of all human suffering, most especially the spiritual suffering, but even that physical suffering that is so much a part of human life. And so that's part of the healing ministry of doctors, as well as all of us who are called to be disciples of the Lord. This reading from Isaiah actually does come from the normal Sunday readings, and I'll talk about that briefly with this reference to Cyrus. I'll talk about that in a little bit, but at least if I think to get back to it. But the second reading that we heard today is from the second letter of Paul to Timothy. Timothy, if you might recall, was a young protege of St. Paul and eventually became the bishop there in the city of Ephesus, which we know today is Izmir, Turkey. But it is, he was also, as Paul traveled around the Mediterranean realm, an assistant of his in evangelizing the peoples around the Mediterranean. And so this little excerpt from Timothy seems like kind of a bunch of random sort of just worldly stuff, right? It's just practicalities. First of all, he's talking about the fact that, you know, to the extent to which St. Paul, who was a total mensch as far as I'm concerned, whined, we're hearing it now, right? He's complaining about the fact that all of those who were associated with him, with the exception of St. Luke, had gone different places. One of them, he specifically points out, Demas, was enamored with the present world and went to Thessalonica. So we don't know whether he actually like just left the ministry altogether or what, but gives the impression that he and Paul kind of got crossways with one another at some point. And Demas decided, well, I'm just going to go do my own thing. The others, it sounds like, were sent to Dalmatia and Galatia and different places to continue the work of building up the churches that were founded there by Paul. And so he's asking Mark, that would be Mark the evangelist, the writer of the second gospel, John Mark, as we hear about him elsewhere, and some others, right, that are in various places. Then he's asking him for typical things. Oh, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus and Troas. You know, bring my coat, please. I forgot that, or I left it there. And also bring all these parchments and these papyrus rolls, just so like all of these, presumably they're things to write letters or actually scriptural writings themselves that he desires to have. Again, it just sounds like mundane stuff, right? But, you know, there are things, there are worldly things that we have to attend to. Which kind of leads me into the normal Sunday gospel, as well as just the discussion of the mundane worldly concern that is nonetheless also a heavenly concern, which is, of course, our political life. And I think, you know, the common conception is that, you know, that, well, when it comes to faith, and especially Christian faith, like, you do that over there somewhere, but it doesn't have a place in the public sphere. Well, to that I say rubbish, because the reality is that politics involves people. It's the conduct of a group of people and how we tend to organize ourselves and live our common life. Well, I'll get into that in a little bit, but really that is the ultimate concern of God. And the faith is precisely that. It teaches us how to live our common life. Well, if you want to call that politics, fine, that's what it is. That's the, kind of by definition, that's what it is. So, now, whenever we say politics, we usually think of something corrupt, right? Well, you know, it's not without justification, I suppose, to think that. But at any rate, it is the interaction of peoples and how that is regulated, how that is done in a systematic way. Our gospel today, that would normally be for today, for the Sunday, is that perennial story of the interaction between Jesus and two different groups, the Pharisees and the Herodians. The Herodians were supporters of the Romans who occupied Palestine and kind of ruled over the Jews at the time of Jesus. The other side, of course, resented this, saw the Jews, of course, as the chosen people, which, of course, we know from the scriptures they were, and resented the Romans very much. But as much as these two groups, the Herodians and the Pharisees, hated one another, saw each other as traitors, they hated Jesus more. And so, in their jealousy, they kind of put their heads together to try to entrap him. And they come up with this devious sort of a question. Should we pay the census tax to Caesar or not? So, if he answers yes, then the Pharisees and those who are these Jewish zealots can condemn him and say that you're a traitor to your people and you're an idolater, right, in a sense. You're not faithful to your own people and to your God. Whereas if he says no, it's not lawful to pay the tax to Caesar, then the Herodians can snap their fingers and bring the Roman soldiers over and say, hey, I got a seditionist here for you. Please take him and string him up for us. Right? That's exactly what they were trying to back Jesus into the corner with. But Jesus, of course, the Son of God and the Creator of the universe, is not going to be that easily taken in. He's pretty canny in his response. And of course, we know the story. He asks for a coin to be brought to him, and he says, what image, whose image, rather, is on this coin, this little bit of silver? And they say, Caesar's. Of course, that was the practice. When a coin was minted, the Caesar at the time, the ruler of that polity at the time, would have their image stamped on it. And so then his response is, then render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and render unto God what is God's. The implication in that, of course, is that because his image is on it, it belongs to him. But what belongs to God then? What has his image stamped upon it? We know the answer to that, right? It's you and it's me, human beings. So we belong to God. It was kind of his way of saying, okay, Caesar can have that little bit of silver. He can have these worldly things. And indeed, he does have a legitimate amount of authority over that. You know, we hear it in our first reading today from Isaiah about King Cyrus, who was the Persian, who actually liberated the chosen people from their enslavement in Babylon and allowed them not only to go back home and be free, but even assisted them in rebuilding the temple that had been torn down by the Babylonians and defiled. He wasn't a Jew. Cyrus is not a Jew. He was not one of the chosen people. He wasn't even a good guy. I mean, he treated certain various peoples really badly. And yet he's referred to as God's anointed, chosen for a particular purpose. Why is he given that title whenever he himself is a pagan and not really even a good guy? It's because he allowed the chosen people of God to go free, and not only that, but to worship the true God. And that's why he's called the anointed. Not that he's perfect or a saint. We don't revere Cyrus as a saint. Probably never will. But he was raised up by God and given this earthly authority for a heavenly purpose, which is, of course, allowing the chosen people to worship God and point the other nations eventually to him, most especially brought to fulfillment in Jesus Christ. So, with regards to what are we to do as Catholics, I have many people asking me, you know, is there a good guide for confession, there is a good guide for confession, it's back there next to the confessional, but is there a good guide for Catholics in discerning how to vote and who to vote for? And in terms of a really comprehensive, wonderful guide, there isn't much in the sense of every single issue. And to be frank, the voter's guide from the USCCB, the Conference of Catholic Bishops here in the United States, is about the next thing to useless. I think I'm more confused after I read the thing than before. So I don't find that helpful. It really kind of tends to muddy the waters and make all issues equal. So I've thought about this for a while, and I think something that we're used to using as an examination of conscience, and that we're hopefully all familiar with, and if we're not familiar with it in the order of it, we need to look it up, is the Ten Commandments. And that's what I encourage you to do as your homework for the next couple of weeks, is to look that up and pray over it and consider what it says. And also consider that not all of those things that are listed off in the Ten Commandments are of equal weight. As with many things in the Scriptures and certainly in the teaching of the Church, the most important things are listed first and then in diminishing importance. And the Ten Commandments is most definitely one of those lists that works in that way. So, if you're to break it down and look at it as a whole, you could break down the Ten Commandments into three different sections. By the way, I mentioned confession earlier. It kind of was on my mind, apparently. But a lot of people will use the Ten Commandments as a guide for confession. And that's good. But you have to keep in mind that we have to interpret it and look at it in a broader sense than just the narrow thing of, okay, well, I didn't worship any golden calves, and I didn't murder anyone, and I didn't commit adultery, per se, so I must be good. Like, no. It's a little more nuanced than that. Think of the Ten Commandments not as a book of morality to follow, but as the table of contents out of the book of morality. Each one of those commandments is a chapter. And we need to go into more details on, you know, for instance, what our relationship with God is to look like, what our relationship with family and authority is to look like, what our relationship to other people and our sexuality is to look like. All of that stuff is a little broader than just that. But it's a great way of looking at the totality of our lives and saying, are we in the right or not? And if we break this down, the first three commandments in the Ten Commandments have to do with our relationship with God. Is He the one that we worship above all things? Are we giving Him due honor and glory and worship every week? Are we being faithful to Him and not idolaters? Right? That's the concern. The proper worship of God. And I would say the free exercise to do so. To live as he has commanded us to live. That is priority number one, because those are the first three commandments. What are the next commandments concern? Honor your father and mother. So family life, moral, properly lived family life is of paramount importance for the formation of children and the love between human beings, and as a foundational building block of the church. So that's also very important. So all things that concern proper family life as God has intended it, and all the ramifications of that. So we're starting at the top of the list. Proper worship of God. Proper structure of the family. And how that's supposed to work. What's number five? Thou shalt not kill. We are not to end innocent human life willy-nilly at our own discretion. That cannot happen. Keep in mind, as we're going through this, I would hope that you would also do your homework, because willful ignorance, you won't get a pass for willful ignorance. If you just decide, I just don't want to look up this stuff, you're still going to be responsible for it, right? I just wanted to warn you that. But okay, so we look at, I don't want to talk about parties. I don't want to talk about people. There's no need. They move their positions around anyway sometimes. But what we need to do is look at, what do the parties say as they stand right now? And how do these line up with the teachings of God, as we can kind of condense down and look at in the Ten Commandments? So God, family life, preservation of innocent human life, and the dignity of persons. This really goes back to the image stamped on us, the image of God. We belong to God. We don't belong to one another. Nobody else belongs to us. We belong to God. He's the only one who has authority over that. So human life. Also, our sexuality, the sixth and the ninth commandments in particular, but the sixth in adultery, right? So it has to do with people. The next most important ones, going all the way through to theft, that starts out the last section, the least important measures, which is things. So it's God, people, things. So the morality and the things that we vote for and the things that we support publicly, we have to follow that order of importance as we discern who is it that we would elect to lead us. Because that's the gift and the responsibility of the country that we live in and the kind of political system that we live in. It is a great blessing that we are afforded an even greater amount of freedom, of in a sense, self-determination, if you want to use that term. But with that gift of freedom comes a great responsibility. Because it isn't just some king somewhere that leads us with no input from us. We put them there. Therefore, we share in a responsibility in that, in what it is that they do, what it is that they don't do. So this is very important. It sounds like, oh God, Father, why don't you talk about something theological? Okay, well, I guess you could tell St. Paul the same thing. I mean, why, Paul, are you talking about cloaks and parchment and all of that stuff, right? The practicalities are important, too. Paul needed the cloak so he didn't freeze to death. He needed the parchments and the papyrus rolls so that he could write letters to people and exhort them in the faith. He needed that stuff. And these practicalities, they do impinge on our spiritual life, no matter how much we might think otherwise. So just invite us all to take that time over these next days. If you haven't already done so, please do. Look over those commandments. And start at the beginning. And don't look at it like, well, you know, so like, you know, this side over here looks like they, you know, I could see how they could agree more with what is said on the whole list. No, no, no. Start at the top and work your way down. Look at it not so much like, okay, well, it's this many of this one and this many of that one, you know, whatever. Look at it like, okay, this one's a non-starter or a starter, okay? Then this next one is a non-starter or a starter, you know, and you kind of work your way down there. We have to do that. I think particularly when it comes to God and human dignity. The stuff can take care of itself. The coins stamped with Caesar's image, in some sense, I won't say they take care of themselves. They're important. They're not as important as the other stuff. And the more we can approach this, these truths in this way, if we don't become forgetful of God, then we're not going to become forgetful of the dignity of the human person. And then we're not going to subjugate the human person and take away their things. You know, like, so the priority is at the top, and then everything else can flow out of that truth. So let's, once again, exhort us all to take that time to pray over this. And if you're looking for a guide, I think, and particularly when it comes to human life, which is kind of one of those starter, non-starter issues, we do have, especially for the local things, we do have the Southwest Indiana Right to Life guides out here on the information table up next to the office window. You know, take advantage of that. Also, a good guide in terms of national platform would be to look at the Priests for Life website, and there is a real breakdown taken from the platforms themselves and quoting the platforms themselves on particular issues, especially when it comes to some of those higher level issues that I kind of lined out in the using the Ten Commandments, you know, in terms of our relationship with God and the dignity of the human person and the preservation of life and human life and all that. So today, and we also just ask St. Luke's intercession that we could be instruments of healing. Pray for those who are, in a very, very literal way, being instruments of healing for those who are suffering right now of COVID or anything at all. And let's ask the Lord in all things to guide us. And one more thing, I want to make one more plug. The last several Mondays, and continuing up through the election, there is a group that get together on Monday nights, 6:30, and they pray together, usually in the gym. They pray together for our nation and that God's wisdom would prevail and his will would prevail in the leadership of our country. And I think that's just a good thing to pray. And I guess maybe finally, I know that this is a contentious thing for many people. You know, we've all grown up hearing, don't talk about religion and politics, right? Well, you know, those are things that impinge on our heavenly life. They really do, even if they're practical. And so we should talk about them. But what we shouldn't do is what is typically happening, which is people make up their minds. And whenever they're challenged, they react not intellectually, but emotionally. And the teeth and the claws come out. Well, that is not the way to actually have a proper discussion. No. And what is the truth? I think that's the thing. We have to be able to step back from our own feelings on things and ask, what is the truth? And to really approach things as they are and as they should be. And to listen to the Word of God and how He directs us, not to listen to ideologies, and certainly, you know, like that whole idea of, well, you know, we've always voted this way, or my family's always voted this way. I'm sorry, that's just not good enough, and that's an idolatry. You know, anytime we put the letter behind somebody's name in greater importance than the teachings of God and His direction and morality, that's idolatry. I'm sorry, that's just what it is. We can't do that, no matter what we may feel personally. We trust, ultimately, that if we follow God, He can work out all things. If we respect Him and His will bring us to a greater, deeper happiness and a greater justice. So we have to place our trust in that.